The National Broadcasting Company presents Analog.
I'm Haskell Lazier. I'm the New York director of the American Jewish Committee. I live in Manhattan, and I've lived in this city for the last 4.5 years. Prior to that, Los Angeles, California.
I'm Bob Gore, director of communications for the New York Urban Coalition. I'm also a Manhattanite. I've lived here for, I'd rather not say how many years.
Were you always living in New York City?
No, as a matter of fact, I was born in North Carolina, and that's where I went to school. Some of my schooling, at any rate. But I've lived in many, many different parts of the country, but I think I like Manhattan best, even though we do have our problems here. Not the least of which is the problem of so many people crowded together in one city.
I lived in Manhattan, just as I told you, for about 4.5 years, and I'm a small-town boy, having been born in Omaha, Nebraska. And this is probably about the sixth or seventh city that I've actually lived in the course of my professional career.
What kind of similarities do you find in these different cities in terms of your work?
Well, I've always been engaged in my professional life in the field of intergroup relations. Today, I guess it's called human relations and civil rights. But there are numbers of similarities across the country that I've found. For example, in Detroit, there was a group of people that were trying to put through a fair employment practices law. And I remember being involved in this for 4 years during the time I was in Detroit. And the same arguments were heard in Detroit as I heard subsequently in Colorado and in California. So there is the similarity in the whole black-white thing wherever I've been in the country. The difference, I think, is probably most pronounced when I spent some time down in Miami, where I was covering the southeastern part of the country and engaging in some of the early sit-ins back around 1959, 1960, somewhere in that period.
Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with you that I worked with CORE for a number of years. I was the Assistant National Director for Community Relations, which was quite a hat to wear because it had to do with public relations, it had to do with community organizing, and you name it, and our department had to do it. But in working in the South, we discovered that there were certain kinds of problems that also obtained in the North. And it seems to me that it's only until a few years ago that people really began to discover similarities. I can recall, for example, in 1962, I wrote an article which became a part of a book called The Angry Black South, and I mentioned then that even though the sit-ins and what have you were going on in the South, that it wouldn't be too long before the same would be in the North, and sure enough, that's exactly what happened. I think actually guys like former Governor Walz are just a little bit more honest about their feelings than some of the more sophisticated New Yorkers or Chicagoans.
I tend to agree with you on that. Where did you work for CORE?
Well, I worked out of the national office here in New York City, but I traveled all over the country. I was in fact, the day of the March on Washington, I had to, rather than go to Washington, go to Plaquemine, Louisiana. Leander Perez.
Leander Perez. I couldn't remember his name.
I'll never forget it.
I think he's no longer with us.
No, he isn't. I presume he's in heaven since the Catholic Church gave him special dispensation to have his funeral in the church. In fact, the bishop there was a little bit against this notion since he had been excommunicated, but that's that church's business, and I won't get into that.
Have you noticed, as I have, a big switch in the whole civil rights movement in the last 5 years or thereabouts?
Well, I think there's certainly a switch. Some people refuse to acknowledge that there is even a civil rights movement as it was known. Certainly one of the major things that's occurred in the last 5 years or so is that there's been much more emphasis on the plurality of this country rather than assuming that we shall all live together and we shall overcome and that kind of thing. I think that black people particularly, and we're noticing it now in what I like to call the Native Americans, or what are usually called Indians, I think we discover that they are also talking about the pluralistic society that we live in. That is to say that everybody is not the same and never will be the same, but that that doesn't mean that each individual group doesn't have value with its own identity. That seems to me the biggest thing that's been pushed recently.
You don't detect a separatism as part of that?
Well, the people I talk to, and I talk to people from all shades of what can be loosely called the movement, I don't see that as really separatism. It's just an acknowledgement of the fact that I am black. I'm not white. I am a Presbyterian. I'm not Jewish. And these things are unlikely to change. But that doesn't mean that I'm better or worse than someone else because of these particular identifications.
I was struck by one of the things you said about things being a little more honest down in the South than they are up in the North. My experience in the South was just exactly that it was easier to deal with head-on prejudice, honestly expressed, albeit wrongly, than it was to deal with the people who talk about, some of my best friends. And then you know that they're not with you for all the polite talk that they've been giving you. And when I ask you just a minute ago whether you had detected a change in the civil rights movement, I'm thinking back to the early 50s when I was involved in a number of civil rights demonstrations, I guess you'd call them demonstrations, and we got together and jointly planned what it was we were going to try to do. And then all of us went at it. I think the thing that probably sticks to me more than anything else is an experience I had out in Los Angeles when we were forming a group called the United Civil Rights Committee. And I remember going to a meeting, and I was always somehow or another in the leadership of the civil rights movement. And at that time, some of the people who were then militants, but who would now be called the moderates, were talking about making the city of Los Angeles aware of discrimination against Negroes by having cars stall in the Cloverleaf, where there's the interchange of all the freeways in Los Angeles. And what they were talking about was four cars in each of the four lanes of the freeway at this Cloverleaf, which would have made, 16 four lanes, I guess, and all of them developing some kind of motor trouble at the same time, thereby adequately blocking every entrance into or out of the city of Los Angeles at this Cloverleaf. And I looked at these fellows and I said, "You wouldn't." And they said, "Yes, we would. It's the only way this community is going to know that we mean business."
Fortunately, though, even those tactics, I can't say they don't work, because I'm sure that in that situation they effectively would have blocked Los Angeles. But I recall when we had here in New York, a friend of mine devised a situation whereby we were going to block the Triborough Bridge using the same tactics. And we did do this, but the problem was that the people who were stalled didn't know why we were doing it, and they had no sympathy for it. So the only thing we did was to cause them to look back. We did pass out leaflets asking them, "Look back over the bridge at Harlem, you know, you're escaping to your martini, et cetera, et cetera." But I'm glad we did that, but I just don't know what beneficial effect it might have had.
That seems to be the problem, that you're never clear on exactly how you get across the demands for change. How do you communicate with the people in the street, by and large, who are decent people? I'm under the impression, for a number of years of work in the field, that if the American public had a choice to make between what was fair and what was unfair, that 9 times out of 10, they would probably go for the fair thing. They knew what it was. Mm. But that we have not been able to show people exactly what that fair choice is about.
I try to play on people's self-interest. I think that usually works better than the other way around. If I can prove to a guy that doing what I want him to do is also or primarily in his self-interest, then it's likely that he'll do it quicker. I can recall a circumstance in one southern town where I was working. The chairman of the Human Rights Committee, or whatever they called it at the time, was a very nice old Southern gentleman. He had two or three PhDs, and we were sitting across this bargaining table. And from my point of view, we were sitting there as equals. He kept referring to me by my first name, Robert, this, this, this. So rather than to call him by his title, I said, "Yes, John, I agree with you." And he looked at me rather shocked. After I had done that a couple of times, it dawned on him what I was saying, and he then referred to me as Mr. Gore.
At which point you called him Doctor.
Right. I think the message has to get across in different ways.
Yeah.
I must say, though, that he was a very well-meaning Southern gentleman, and after we got across some of the original hurdles, he was, in fact, extremely helpful in desegregating those lunch counters there in that particular city.
You know, I think timing is a lot of it. I remember back in 1948, I believe, when I was stationed in Detroit, Michigan, and I got a call from a place called Kalamazoo, where the town had just put up a brand new apartment building. It was for Kalamazoo, I guess what they would call a high-rise by New York standards. It would probably be a townhouse in terms of the height. But this was an apartment building that was probably the choice place to live in all of Kalamazoo if you didn't have your own home. And I remember a couple of kids who called me and said that they had made a deposit on the apartment, and just a week before they were supposed to take occupancy, they were told that the management of the building didn't want Jews. And I went down to Kalamazoo and met with the kids, and I told them they had the choice of doing three things. One thing was to do nothing, because discrimination does exist against Jews and other minorities in the country, and you always have that choice of doing nothing and living with it. The second choice they had was to try to take the case to the public and tell the story adequately. And the third was to file a breach of contract suit, because they were, in fact, signers of a contract. And I told the kids, if we took the course, which I would recommend, of telling the story to the public, the chances were that a lot of pressure would be brought on them from a number of kooks in the community. Well, you know, they took that choice of telling their story to the public. And then came the next problem, how you tell the story. Because this was a case of discrimination. And it was an obvious case of discrimination. And we went to the newspapers, and the papers wouldn't touch it. They said it wasn't too newsworthy, besides which they were afraid, perhaps, of some kind of a suit. We cast about, I think, for a day and a half before we finally found a radio station in the city where there was a commentator that was willing to tell the story. And, you know, the interesting thing was that when the commentator started the story, he was talking about the 25th anniversary of communism and conditions behind the Iron Curtain, and all of a sudden he switched and said, "Now, how are things in Kalamazoo?" And then he told the story of this young couple, boy being a veteran, and what had happened with him and the renting of the apartment. And this was a town which, at that time, was a very conservative town politically. And the reaction to the story was just so spontaneous from the whole city that it took no more than 2 days after the story was out, and the management of the building was offering the kids an apartment in the building. Now, this was a beautiful kind of a success story, but it had to do with timing. And the reaction of the community, again, bolstered this business about the American public being fair. And I would suspect that this is the kind of thing that people could see in terms of either right or wrong. We would be able to make a lot more progress.
I think what happens so many times, though, is that this whole business of right or wrong, fair or unfair, tends to get obscured by the jaundiced view, if you will, of the party who doesn't want to perform. I think one of the current examples would be what's happening to the Black Panthers, not only in New York City, but in other cities. Now, if we, for the moment, disregard, though that's difficult for me to do, disregard what their platform is, if we look at it simply as a case of justice or injustice, it's pretty hard for me not to suggest that they've been treated very, very unjustly. Take New York, for example, where they've had incredibly high bail placed on them, whereas, again, they were accused of allegedly conspiring to blow up department stores. And then you have a group of others who, in fact, did blow up several federal buildings, and their bail was much lower. In fact, some of them even are out in the streets now. I mean, this is a clear case of justice and injustice, but it gets beclouded with so many other emotional things.
I'd like to talk about that for a little bit more, because I consider myself to be a civil libertarian. And when I see the Panther 21, who are coming to trial, I guess, almost momentarily, being held in high bail, I begin to ask myself some questions about the legitimacy of that kind of bail, just as you raised it. And I raised the question the other day with a city official and asked him why these people were held in such high bail. Unfortunately, he pointed out to me that one of the Panthers, one or more of the Panthers who previously had been released on bail, had jumped bail. Not only had jumped bail, but had fled the country. I think we have to differentiate between the Panthers and individuals, too. My own estimate, and you may disagree with this, is that while the Panthers' rhetoric has indicated a communist line, I think there's no doubt that they've taken a communist line. But some of the things that they've tried to do by way of pressure probably are legitimate. Not even probably. I'll strike the word probably.
One of the interesting things I noticed in the New York Times recently was the notice of a new book coming out by Justice Douglas. And I think the reason it got so much attention in the Times was that Justice Douglas said in no uncertain terms that if a society reaches a certain point where it is unwilling to redress certain grievances, then the only honorable thing to do is to create a revolution. I was quite surprised to hear a person like that come out with that suggestion. In fact, he mentioned the original American Revolution and the fact that the establishment today is looked upon by many people the same way that King George was looked upon by the early Americans.
I would like to read the whole Justice Douglas text on that, because I suspect that while he may have made that kind of a statement, that he surrounded it by a lot of other things. I don't think you can draw the same analogy between what happened at the American Revolution and King George and the establishment today in a democracy where you have a constitution which is homegrown.
Yeah, well, there is a difference, because even though we do have a constitution, for many black people particularly, that constitution is abrogated every day of the year. Many people see no reason to get involved in the constitutional questions when they know that in their own lives it's abrogated all the time.
And yet if we deteriorate to a society of vigilante movements, and I put the Panthers down as a vigilante group, just as I put down the Jewish Defense League as a vigilante group. These are self-appointed people who are going to change the society to conform to whatever they feel that society ought to be. And there is nothing to prevent the proliferation of these kinds of groups if you stand idly by and let them flourish. I don't see any more reason for a Black Panthers and a Jewish Defense League and an Irish something and an Italian something else and a Polish something else, because by the time you get through with these kinds of movements, if you took it to, the end, we might be such a society of splinters that we'd beat each other's throats.
Well, one of the obvious answers to that, for me at least, is to make the Constitution work for everyone.
I agree with that.
But that's been a rather long, drawn-out process, and it gets a little sticky sometimes for some people.
Now, let's get back to the Panthers, though, for a minute, because I think we're running into a trap here. The more I look at it, the more I think it's a trap. My own feeling, and it's just a feeling in communication with a number of people in the black community, is that the Black Panthers no more speak for the black community than the Jewish Defense League speaks for the Jewish community.
I would think that would be true.
And as a matter of fact, while there are people in both communities who are saying, bravo, go to it, fellas, the rank and file community are not supportive of vigilante groups of this kind.
I would agree, except that, unfortunately, or I'm sure from the Panthers' point of view, fortunately, when things occur like the kind of repressive tactics that have been used against them, that engenders more support for them.
Exactly. I think we've handled it rather stupidly. What the authorities tend to do is to take an organization which, if properly handled, would dry up and make it, instead, a group that is really a martyr group that will gain support that they don't necessarily deserve in the first instance. I should make it more categorical than that, because for me, any group which preaches violence, which preaches armed violence, which preaches the overthrow of duly constituted authorities by armed revolution, whether it's the Minutemen, whether it is whatever the group may be, I think represents a danger to the country and all of the people in the country, not just, you know, blacks or just whites or Jews or Italians or whatever the case may be. And I think we've been very stupid in the way we've handled the whole Black Panther movement and all of the movements which do preach the kind of extremist philosophy that they do. Now, maybe you're in disagreement with that, I don't know.
Well, not total disagreement, but I still think we have to look at whichever one of these movements we're looking at in some kind of perspective. For example, we hear frequently about how the Panthers are preaching violence when, as a matter of fact, they're talking about self-defense in their own community, where it's been proved that the powers that be are really retaliating against the community for no apparent reason. The other thing I think that we haven't looked at is the good points about what they're doing. That breakfast program they're doing should be carried on by the federal government.
Absolutely. Absolutely. The breakfast program, whether it's by the Panthers or the Young Lords, certainly ought to be carried on by some arm of government.
Speaking of the Young Lords, that lead poisoning thing they're getting into, it was fantastic the way the city just had no responsibility for this horrible thing that's going on in our city. The city took no responsibility for this, and so the Young Lords took it on themselves to create some kind of health program that was significant. So given all of the negatives that we hear about these programs, I think it's important that we at least look into some of the positive aspects of it and maybe build those positive aspects.
But not through those kinds of organizations. I agree with you that some of the things these groups are doing are good. But those things which these groups are doing, which are good, ought to be done by groups which have a wider base and a more peaceful philosophy of getting them done. And I suspect if we could get the establishment, whatever that is at the moment, and I'm not sure what the establishment is at the moment, to adopt some of the programs that some of the far-out groups are doing, we would have scored quite a coup. I think, you know, and I hate to say this, but I think that when you have extremist groups in your midst, whatever that might be at the moment, because when Martin Luther King came into the national scene, he was regarded as an extremist. What it does is to prick the conscience of the collective public and cause some kind of forward movement. Now, unfortunately, these movements are not sustained. It always has to take some kind of a different and I can't even find the word, a different prod to be applied so that pressure is constant in order for groups to move. I'm thinking now of some of the things that were picked up here 2 or 3 years ago when the National Association of Businessmen, for example, formed their program to employ people from the hardcore unemployed. And they made a tremendous effort to do all kinds of hiring. And all of a sudden, as I view it, this program is beginning to slip away and kind of slack off. Now, I may be all wet in my estimate of that kind of a program, but how do you sustain, what I'm really trying to say is, how do you sustain this kind of movement for change when there isn't the kind of pressure that you and I have been talking about from some of the extremist groups?
Well, actually, the National Alliance of Businessmen, they still are working. I guess maybe we don't hear as much about it because it's not as spectacular as it was when they first started out.
In all probability, that's it.
We at the New York Urban Coalition, for example, are working very closely with the National Alliance of Business, and I think in the, I don't know what time element was involved, but we managed for businessmen to help them create, what, more than 9,000 jobs in a very short period of time. So as I say, that kind of effort still going on just frequently isn't as spectacular as it is when it first comes to view. The other thing I wanted to mention, we were talking earlier about groups which preach violence. I can't help but say that I think that these patterns of behavior are learned patterns. For example, if we have in New York City a paramilitary structure like the police department, they do use violence, presumably for the safety of the citizens, but still, there they are. And people begin to learn, okay, the way to get things done is the use of violence. I think even on a national level, when we have disagreements with various countries, well, how do we handle it? We have our military operation, that's how we handle it. So I think this is a sort of sifting down of attitudes, values, that can't help but affect people who want to make change.
You're talking about a collective psychology of violence being acceptable in the country. And I quite agree with you. It's something that I think we have to start to change, but I haven't found the formula for doing it.
And neither have I. As soon as I do, I'll let you know.
You have been listening to Analog, a radio series we present this week in cooperation with the American Jewish Committee. Our guests today were Haskell Lazier, New York Director of the American Jewish Committee, and Robert Gore, Director of Communications for the New York Urban Coalition. On each of these analog broadcasts, we have asked the participants to share something with us that has guided them and might be considered food for thought. Today, Haskell Lazier cited what he called his pet quotation: "One man of courage will make a majority." And Robert Gore agreed. He felt it expressed his own beliefs. Facey speaking. This recorded program, produced by Rhoda Grady and directed by Jeffrey Culliver, has been an NBC Public Affairs presentation. This is the NBC Radio Network.